In this season of tight wallets and open hearts, it might be wise to choose holiday gifts that will stay around for a while. Books, for instance. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg has gathered seasonal picks from some trusty independent booksellers around the country.
Family Strife, A Murder and Evolution. Leave it to Rona Brinley at the Bookmark in Atlantic Beach, Florida, to mix up a spicy stew. Let's start with Family Strife, Jonathan Tropper's novel, This Is Where I Leave You.
There's nothing like a good crisis to bring a family together and tear them apart and then hopefully bring them back together again.
There's been a death in the Foxman family, the father. Mrs. Foxman insists that her children come home and stay home for a week of mourning.
This is a Jewish family, so they're sitting shiva, but it could be any dysfunctional family. You've got one son who just found his wife having an affair, another couple that's trying to have a baby, another one who shows up with some strange girlfriend.
Rona Brinley says in this family's time together, the nice ones act nicer, the crazies get even crazier, and in Jonathan Tropper's hands, it's funny, keen, and on occasion, lewd. The Making of Family is one theme of Little B by Chris Cleave. It's Daniel Golden's favorite book this year. Golden runs Boswell Books in Milwaukee and admires the story of a young Nigerian girl who gets stuck in a British immigration detention center. Little B begins this way.
How I would love to be a British pound. A pound is free to travel to safety, and we are free to watch it go. This is the human triumph. This is called globalization. A girl like me gets stopped at immigration, but a pound can leap the turnstiles and dodge the tackles of those big men with their uniform caps and jump straight into a waiting airport taxi. Where to, sir? Western civilization, my good man, and make it snappy.
Daniel Golden says Little B is funny and smart.
But she's not book smart. And she has a wonderful humor about her, despite the fact that she's been through a really terrible thing in her past.
The book is about rebuilding family under duress. One of Daniel Golden's Milwaukee customers described Little B this way.
The story is about sacrifice and how much you would give up to do the right thing.
Back in Atlantic Beach, Florida, Rona Brinley's next book pick is a murder mystery in which no one is much concerned with doing the right thing. Rona says Harry Dolan's first novel, Bad Things Happen, is less about who done it than who is really who.
People have so many secrets. They're not who they say they are. They've changed their names. You're not sure who the dead body is.
Bad Things Happen starts with a bang.
The shovel has to meet certain requirements, a pointed blade, a short handle to make it maneuverable in a confined space. He finds what he needs in the gardening section of a vast department store. He stows the shovel in his cart and moves unhurriedly through the wide aisles, gathering a few more items, D-cell batteries, a bag of potting soil, a can of weed killer. Leather work gloves, two pairs. In the grocery section, he picks up four deli sandwiches wrapped in plastic and a case of bottled water.
Ooh, so he's either having a garden party because of all the sandwiches, or he's burying a body and covering it up with plants and bologna, or...
Well, I think that you probably have a good guess.
Rona Brinley's final holiday gift pick is a poetry collection put together by children's poet laureate Marianne Hoberman and Linda Winston. The book is called The Tree That Time Built. Rona says this anthology of more than 100 poems is built around the theme of evolution.
How many species are there? Why are there so many different kinds? How long have they been here? All the basic questions that Darwin would raise.
There's a vast range of poets, Walt Whitman, Robert Frost, Langston Hughes, and Ogden Nash, his poem about termites.
Some primal termite knocked on wood and tasted it and found it good. And that is why your cousin May fell through the parlor floor today.
The Tree That Time Built comes with a CD on which sound effects have been added so you can hear the termites tapping away as that poem is read. Looking is the recommendation of Lucia Silva, who buys books for Portrait of a Bookstore in Studio City, California. She wants us to look at a book of iconic photographs edited by Steve Christ. It's called The Contact Sheet.
The contact sheet was made when you laid all of the negatives from a roll onto a sheet of photo paper and made a print. So you have all these rows of successive shots. So you can see the progression of, you know, the 24 or 36 or 12 shots on a roll.
The book offers contact sheets from various photo shoots. Robert Doisneau's lovers kissing in Paris, Dorothea Lange's Depression-era migrant mother. In each case, Lucia says, you see the outtakes as well as the final choice.
You see what makes a photograph the one. You see all of these ones that aren't the one, and then you see the one that stands out.
The book includes quotes from each photographer, the history of the picture, and how final choices were made. Final choices and arriving at them figure in another Lucia Silva gift book pick, the Paris Review Interviews, a boxed set of some 50 years' worth of conversations with some of our greatest writers about how they work, what, and why they write.
It's like a writing course in a box. It's this window into the writer's mind about all things personal and political, as well as about other artists and techniques.
The Paris Review Interviews are full of insights. For instance, Joan Didion's writing process.
Every day she retypes what she has so far in her manuscript. So if she has 50 pages, she retypes those 50 pages and then keeps going to get under the rhythm. And I just thought that was a fantastic technique.
It's fantastic. And it sure puts off writing for a little bit.
Right. Or at least you have somewhere to start.
And maybe this collection of suggestions from our independent booksellers gives you a place to start for your book-giving list this holiday season. Thanks to Rona Brinley at the Bookmark in Atlantic Beach, Florida, Daniel Golden at Boswell Books in Milwaukee, and Lucia Silva of Portrait of a Bookstore in Studio City, California. In Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
A list of these and more choices from the booksellers is at our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News.
When Raymond Carver died in 1988, the Times of London dubbed him the American Chekhov. Carver is still considered one of the greatest modern short story writers. Now there's a new, nearly 600-page biography called Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life. Author Susan Jane Gilman has this review.
Confession. The first time I read a Raymond Carver story, I didn't get it. It was so spare, so lacking epiphany, I thought, huh? But then I read his story, A Small Good Thing, and Cathedral, and Neighbors. I read his collection, Where I'm Calling From, and then I got it. Carver's stories are unadorned tales of ordinary people. Their very simplicity and elegance pack a deep emotional punch. This is why Carver's often extolled as a master of minimalism. Which is ironic, because according to Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life by Carol Sklenica, Carver's own life wasn't minimalist at all. It was stunningly chaotic. Ray, as he was known, was like many of the characters he wrote about. A working-class boy in Yakima, Washington, he married his sweetheart, Marianne Burke, at age 19. They had two children in less than 2 years and lived hand-to-mouth. Marianne often waitressed and juggled jobs so Ray could write, and they moved around a lot. Until he was 41, Carver never held down a job for more than 18 months. The only constant was his writing. Rejection slips mounted, but he started to publish. He and Marianne drank and fought violently, though, and their lives spun out of control. Twice they filed for bankruptcy, at least once Ray almost landed in jail, and at least once Marianne was rushed to the emergency room after Ray beat her. Unlike many famous writers, however, Carver managed to stop drinking. Although he died at age 50 in 1988, in the last decade of his life he achieved sobriety. With this came unprecedented literary success and a redemptive love with the poet Tess Gallagher. His own story ended with a measure of grace. Given this, it would be easy for Sklenica to write a dishy, sensational bio or a hagiography. Thankfully, she does neither. Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life, is a sober, sensitive portrait of an often drunken and complex man. Sklenica clearly adores Carver's work, but does a fine job of portraying his poignant contradictions. He's funny and abusive, insecure and dogged, nervous and passionate. She's careful to distinguish the man from his writing. Even when she draws parallels between his life and his fiction, it's to illuminate his creative process. Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life, is an honest portrait of a man's messy, triumphant literary struggle. It neither condemns nor exonerates him. In this way, the book is an ultimate tribute to Carver. As a writer, he was, after all, revered for being both unflinching and tender. And Sklenica's biography is exactly this, unflinching and tender. It is a big, good thing.
Susan Jane Gilman reviewing the new biography, Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life, by Carol Sklenica. Gilman's latest book is a memoir called Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven.
To know me is to fly with me. This is where I live. When I run my card, the system automatically prompts the desk clerk to greet me with this exact statement.
Pleasure to see you again, Mr. Bingham.
It's these kinds of systemized friendly touches that keep my world in orbit.
That's George Clooney in a scene from the new film Up in the Air. He's playing a business traveler who loves what most people find most alienating and irritating about travel, airports and plane rides. In a few minutes, we'll meet the director of the film, Jason Reitman, who also directed Juno and Thank You for Smoking. Up in the Air is adapted from the satirical novel by Walter Kern, who we're going to hear from first. The novel is about a business traveler who virtually lives in what he describes as Air World and has come to feel most at home there. His ambition is to earn 1 million frequent flyer miles, and he's close to achieving it. His job keeps him in the air. Companies around the country bring him in to deliver the bad news to their employees that they're being downsized out of a job. I spoke to Walter Kern in July 2001 when the book was published, just 2 months before 9/11 changed air travel. But Kern's descriptions still ring true. Our interview started with a reading.
Planes and airports are where I feel at home. Everything fellows like you dislike about them, the dry recycled air alive with viruses, the salty food that seems drizzled with warm mineral oil, the aura-sapping artificial lighting, has grown dear to me over the years, familiar, sweet. I love the Compass Club lounges in the terminals, especially the flagship Denver Club with its digital juice dispenser and deep suede sofas and floor-to-ceiling views of taxiing aircraft. I love the restaurants and snack nooks near the gates, stacked to their heat lamps with whole wheat mini pizzas and gourmet caramel rolls. I even enjoy the sweet hotels built within sight of the runways on the ring roads, which are sometimes as close as I get to the cities that my job requires me to visit. I favor rooms with kitchenettes and conference tables, and once I cooked a Christmas feast in one, serving glazed ham and sweet potato pie to a dozen janitors and maids. They ate with me in rotation on their breaks, one or two at a time, so I really got to know them, even though most spoke no English. I have a gift that way. If you and I hadn't hit it off like this, if the only words we'd passed were, "That's my seat," or "Done with that business week," or just, "Excuse me," I'd still regard us as close acquaintances and hope that if we met again up here, we wouldn't be starting from zero as just two suits. Twice last October, I sat in the same row on different routes as 1989's Miss USA, the one who remade herself as a Washington hostess and supposedly works nonstop for voting rights. In person, she's tiny, barely over 5 feet. I put her carry-on in the overhead. But you know some of this already. You fly, too. It just hasn't hooked you. You just don't study it. Hey, you're probably the normal one.
That's Walter Kern reading from his novel, Up in the Air. Walter Kern, how did you start studying airline culture?
A few years ago, I was on a plane upgraded to first class for some unknown reason, and I sat down next to a businessman. And to make conversation, I asked him where he lived, and he said, well, right here. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And it came out that the man had no home. He traveled on business and lived from hotel to hotel, and airplanes and airports, as in the book, were really his turf. And I asked him after a while how he managed to live like this. Wasn't it depressing and so on? And no, he seemed satisfied and even happy with his life. And after I got off the plane, I thought, now, what kind of life would that be? And over the years, I sort of filled in the blanks, and the result was this book.
Well, you've kind of defined a whole culture as Air World. Describe the culture to us.
Well, Air World is that conglomeration of places that are no place, including airports, the hotels that are just off the runways that serve them, the rental car counter, the whole sort of attempt to satisfy the flyer's needs without any particular offense or any particular flavor. I mean, in Air World, you can come from Dallas, Minneapolis, Philadelphia, or New York and know where you are, know what's on offer, know how to get it, and what you're going to get.
And you write that the hometown papers of Air World are USA Today and the Wall Street Journal.
Exactly. Everything is standardized. Everything goes down easily. It's as though the only restaurant in the world were McDonald's and the only hotel in the world was a Holiday Inn. And, you know, people have to be able to rest and feel comfortable and feel at home at any moment, at any time. The result has been this kind of placeless place that I call Air World.
One of the things I found interesting of your whole description of Air World is that in defining this culture of Air World, you've taken one of the more alienating contemporary experiences, flying, an experience in which everyone is a stranger to each other on the plane and everyone is uncomfortable, and you've turned it into this community. I mean, it's not really a community, but, you know, for the purposes of this novel, it's become this, like, anti-community community.
Well, it is a community. I mean, human beings are amazingly adaptable. You bring in a new technology or you force people to live in a new environment and they find ways to do it. And my character has made friends with the people who, you know, sell the juice at the counter, the person who gives the little chair massages in the terminal. He knows the flight attendants by name. I talked to a traveler once who said, I knew I was in trouble. I knew I was flying too much when I walked through the Minneapolis airport and found myself waving to everyone.
I managed to read your novel Up in the Air while in the air. In my Air Flight magazine, on the same day I was reading your book, the back page, I was shocked. It had an ad for enhancing your breast size and another one for male virility enhanced guaranteed. I thought that was were kind of shocking for airline magazines.
Well, that's an odd syndrome. I think when people get on planes, they start to think about improving themselves. They start to think about and get reflective and meditative about where are they going in life? What are they doing in life? And they're prey to these ads for, like you say, you know, breast-enhancing creams and vocabulary-enhancing tape courses. And you'll see those magazines are often aimed at businessmen who are insecure about their negotiating skills, and there will be an ad for a seminar on negotiating or whatever. I think people get a sense of possibility when they're on a plane, even romantic possibility, wondering if the perfect person is going to sit down next to them or something.
Because your character is surrounded by this culture of advertising and franchise food and how-to cassettes and self-improvement stuff, did you have to immerse yourself in some of that too, just so you could get all the language right?
Yeah, I did. I mean, we're immersed in it anyway. Really, all I had to do was notice how immersed I already am. Once you're alert to it and not filtering it out, it's sort of the air you breathe. And this was a book that really came about not through doing research or digging, but through waking up to the fact that I lived in this sort of miasma of messages and images, which I often felt superior to and ignored, but suddenly I decided to wake up to it. Sort of like Andy Warhol became comfortable with the cannibal soup can. You know, it wasn't as though he'd never been to a supermarket. He just suddenly looked at a supermarket and went, wait, art can happen here too.
So what were some of the things that started to strike you as interesting instead of filtering them out?
Well, one thing that struck me about Air World is that it's a class system in a way that most of America isn't. We like to think of ourselves as a democracy and egalitarian, but you get to Air World and there is a rating and a level for everyone. You know, you see the cards they whip out at the ticket counter. I'm a gold medallion member, or I'm a gold medallion member plus, and that entitles me to XYZ. And there are all these distinctions being made out there between types of people and better customers and, you know, the kind of pillow you're going to get or whether you'll get your glass cup or your plastic cup. And that class system in Air World I found interesting.
Oh, it's so true. And they even call it class. I mean, it's like first class or coach class. I mean, you know what class you're in and what privileges that class allows you. Or what miseries
exactly
you're in store for.
Well, I mean, the higher classes sort of allow the miseries to abate somewhat, though not disappear.
Well, shrimp cocktail will do a lot to abate misery. Yeah,
exactly. And people cling to those little perks when
that's
they're
right
traveling in a sort of horribly pathetic way. You know, I've noticed that the few times I've traveled first class myself, you've already got your drink and your coat has been taken by the time the rest of the passengers file on. And it's hard not to feel sorry for them. They're sort of trooping past you like cows to slaughter, and you're sitting there in your, you know, wide body seat. And the funny thing about that class system is it's not really based on money. You know, some of these guys don't make more money who ride in first class. They just fly a lot, and so the airplane, you know, the airline puts them up. And so it's the one time in their life they get to feel on top of the heap, and they take it for all it's worth.
Walter Kern, recorded in July 2001 after the publication of his novel Up in the Air. A new paperback edition has just been published.